everyone, and welcome to Risky Business number 302. I'm Patrick Gray. This week's show is coming to you from the RuxCon Breakpoint Security Conference at the Intercontinental Hotel in Melbourne. So this week's feature interview is a chat with Jonathan Brossard of Toucan Security, and we're talking to him about his presentation on bypassing and generally messing with sandbox malware scanners, kit like FireEye, that sort of stuff. This week's show is brought to you by HackLabs, the Australian penetration testing firm. And we'll be chatting with HackLabs head honcho, Chris Gatford, in this week's sponsor interview. And we're talking to him about an early implementation of something we've been expecting. It's an NFC authentication scheme developed by IBM. Will it catch on? That is coming up a little bit later on. But first, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines. And of course, I'm joined by Adam Boileau now to discuss the week's news. And Adam, how's your breakpoint going?
Yeah, it's going really well. I'm enjoying it. Jonathan's talk, as the listeners will discover, was good fun.
It was good fun. Not so much good fun for FireEye, but
a little bit less so for them. Yes,
I think you and I, we should have a bit of a chat towards the end of the news segment about that, because there's been some controversy. Adam. It's always fun. Now Sacre Bleu, kicking off this week's news. Apparently, Le Monde's allegations against the NSA are false, according to America. They totally didn't spy. They totally didn't do anything wrong.
It's quite thoroughly believable, isn't it? I mean, the NSA comes out and says, that one thing, like of all the things that have been reported about us, that one thing we didn't really do.
And it's funny because then Snowden pulls out a document and goes, yeah, you did.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we're not really going to believe exactly what they're saying here, but they're asserting that they did not actually collect, 70 million call records from the French populace, or indeed spy on, French public officials and that sort of thing. But, the French don't seem particularly happy about it either way.
Speaking of Europeans who are not happy with the NSA, Angela Merkel, who is the Chancellor of Germany, is a little bit peeved over apparent US spying on her cell phone. She's like world renowned for being like glued to her cell phone all of the time. So, deeply personally upsetting to poor Angela Merkel.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can see it. I mean, you would be pissed off with people listening to your phone. But yes, when you're the leader of, an ally country, having your cell phone spied on by your allies does seem a little bit rude. And of course, the Germans take, privacy fairly seriously after, I guess we don't mention Zavor, but they do take it rather seriously after that. And of course, seeing them invoke the name of the Stasi is always, I think it's going to go down fairly poorly in Germany.
Yeah, there's got to be, what's that rule on the internet about comparing people to Nazis? Like, does it work with the Stasi?
Godwin's law.
That's right. Is there a similar law for comparing people to the Stasi?
Probably.
But let me guess, the NSA is saying they didn't do this one.
Yeah. Well, totally wasn't us. It was the French. Yeah, they did.
It was those other guys. Now there's this really weird story on Wired that alleges that, David House, who's that supporter of Bradley Manning, he's the guy, he was the head of the Manning support network or whatever. He's told Wired that he was called to a meeting with Julian Assange, where Julian Assange asked him to gain access to, what's his name, Dominic Domscheit-Berg or whatever, the former WikiLeaks number two, where they had that big falling out. He was writing a book. Apparently, Julian Assange asked David House to gain access to this guy's apartment and steal the manuscript as like this this test to see if he could become, involved in WikiLeaks.
It does seem like a particularly bizarre story. You can just imagine this guy's trying to rustle up some money and support for the Bradley Manning thing, and he ended up with Julian Assange asking you to burgle someone. bought this guy a plane ticket to Berlin and sent him round to Dorschetberg's house to go rob him. I mean, it's crazy talk.
Well, I mean, it is alleged. I mean, of course, meeting apparently took place, like they had a bit of a chat, and then they were actually passing notes and burning them in the fire, and it's just.
That's why you're so cray.
Well, he wanted to talk about Manning. Apparently, Julian Assange seemed more concerned with his image, which is totally not like him at all.
Not even slightly, no.
Oh, now, here's an awesome new product or service from LinkedIn.
Yeah, apparently LinkedIn, they have this new product for mobile devices, where it will insert a LinkedIn footer and invitation and information block about you into your emails. Now, of course, Apple doesn't particularly like people messing with the built-in mail software on iOS. So instead, LinkedIn implement a man-in-the-middle proxy that sits in between your IMAP and SMTP clients, and then injects the this LinkedIn blob into your mail, which, I mean, there's just so many things wrong with this particular idea. But I'm like, what are LinkedIn even thinking? But certainly, anytime you're installing an app on your phone and it doesn't come as an app, it comes as one of these system properties packages that, you know, you can reconfigure your phone. It's the same way you install like mobile device management software and it can reconfigure all your settings. That's what it has to do to change your mail server settings. It's just a poor, very, very poor idea. And, you know, given that LinkedIn's been owned and, you know, do we trust them?
Everyone's been owned. Right, why single them out? Well, you know?
Fair enough, I suppose. But either way, this seems like a fairly shit idea in you know, my fairly humble opinion.
Now, apparently DARPA want to pay, they're offering up to $2 million for automated patching technology, which is kind of interesting. They basically want patches to find vulnerable hosts. Instead of you finding a vulnerable host and then patching it, they want new patches that will actually go and seek out vulnerable boxes, which is, I don't know, I would have thought would be worth more than $2 million if you could track that enough. You know?
Well, and this is the problem. It's a very, very complicated problem. So I mean, my initial reaction when I read this was, well, you know, this is just, you know, this is, you know, academic bullshit. It's not really going to result in anything useful. But on the other hand, like, DARPA does pay for and fund some fairly sensible things. And, you know, $2 million, I guess you could build, you know, something that did at least a subset of what you would imagine. But I mean, we've talked about this kind of, you know, beneficial worm that wanders around the network owning shit and then patching up behind it. And we've generally agreed as an industry that this is just a poor idea. Like, yeah, you do have to give some kind of control or some kind of oversight. And, you know, clearly there is middle ground between own all the things, patch all the things, and doing everything manually. But it'll be interesting to see what comes out. But I'm not super confident that we will see something useful out of this.
No, I can't say that I think that will solve it. You know? There we go. We can all go get a coffee. Yeah. It's done. Now, Google Ideas, they've come up with a couple of ideas there. Well, funnily enough, they're looking at, they've got this new thing called, UProxy or whatever. You can install it so I can install it on my machine and let my buddies in China proxy their connections through my box so that they can read about, I don't know, Falun Gong or whatever. And then they've got another bunch of DDoS prevention stuff coming out. But what do you think of both of these?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Google expanding and using their expertise to address, you know, some of these little problems that we have. Or in DDoS mitigation, like, Google has very, very big pipes. They are probably in a position to be able to soak DDoS in a distributed manner better than most people. So for them, you know, it would not be unreasonable, I mean, given they have to have that capability themselves, to then provide it elsewhere. And they're digital attack map that they've released, which, you know, shows DDoS traffic around the world. You know, certainly interesting and something you would project on the wall in your NOC to make it look like you're actually, you know, doing something security related at work instead of, you know, browsing Imgur. But yeah, this uProxy thing is interesting. I mean, the idea that you have kind of, you know, individual personal level peer to peer proxying, I mean, it's kind of cool in a, you know, hippie sort of way, I guess.
Oh, this is horrible stuff. We're moving into, there's a bit of a creepy theme through the next few articles. There's this idea of, you know, we got do not track, you know, do not call registers and whatnot. Looks like we might have a new type of register coming to the United States, which is a do not track for like the meat space. So, you know, they've got all these creepy technologies that can follow you and your phone around shopping centers and figure out, you know, where you stopped at a window to look at what, and then they can figure out what to market at you because they know what was in the window when you looked at it, that sort of thing. Apparently, we might actually be getting to a world where we actually need to go and register for don't track my movements around a shopping center. Creepy.
It is. It's creepy. And the fact that there are so many, something like, what, 10 companies in the US that are providing this kind of tracking software for stores where you put, you know, essentially Bluetooth and wireless receivers around your shop and then triangulate the location of individual stations as people walk around the shop with them. Like, the fact that there's that many companies doing this, and something like 8 of the 10 have currently are agreeing on a voluntary standard to trying to implement this kind of do not track. But yeah, it's just creepy. Like, we shouldn't even have to have this conversation, you know, that this is a bad thing and that they should, you know, maybe not be quite so creepy about it.
Well, I mean, when they put in those tracking rubbish bins or whatever in London, you know, the whole place went berserk. And yet, you know, you go over to the free old US of A and it's like, you know, everyone's tracking your movements through shopping centers to, you know, to within a couple of centimeters, right? So that's, yeah.
Yeah, do not want.
Do not want. Speaking of do not want, a tool called FB Stalker has popped up, which automates data mining over Facebook Graph Search, which is kind of what people were worried about with Graph Search to begin with.
Well, you know? Exactly, yeah. A couple of dudes from Trustwave Spider Labs have actually, you know, implemented a front end to allow you to search the Facebook graph in a relatively, you know, easy way and produce, I think it glues into, is it Multigo on the output, and lets you, you know, stalk people on Facebook using the graph search, which is exactly what we were worried about in the first place. So yeah, like, you know, simultaneously news and not news, because what else did you think was going to happen?
Yeah. Someone's doing creepy stuff on Facebook. Stop press.
I'm horrified.
Oh my God. New feature interview. Oh, this is hilarious. Krebs gave us the wonderful news that Experian has actually been selling consumer data to an ID theft organization. So you've got an anti-ID theft organization selling data to a theft organization. Weird stuff, right? Talk about your dual purpose data.
Well, exactly, yeah. But you know, it really makes sense, right? I mean, there are these companies that do this very large scale data aggregation and then sell it, you know, for businesses to base their business model on. And the fact that some of these businesses are, you know, identity theft sites, sites that will give you, you know, personal information about people for money. The fact that they're actually just, you know, straight out buying the data instead of stealing it, right? It's just business. What do you think was going to happen? But
well,
yeah,
it's going to help them out with their fulls, right? Like getting full, you know, yeah, that's it. I mean, fill in a few missing fields, yeah, pay the company. Great.
Yeah, but no, it's interesting to see that you know, Experian have been attempting to cooperate with tracking down some of the people who've been running these full sites. They managed to get a guy from Vietnam lured to Guam and then extradited, or renditioned, however you want to call it, across to the U.S. for this particular case. But yeah, I mean, the question really comes down to, you know, what did Experian think was going on when they were getting wire transfers from Singapore every month, you know, for who knows what, and you know, all this data.
Well, I mean, how do you ensure that your customers are legit when you're such a big organization?
Well, exactly.
I mean, that's the problem. It's very easy for us to sit here and go, oh, Experian, you know, what a bunch of idiots. But how are they going to know? Like,
isn't that their business to know about?
Well, I guess.
People,
right? Okay, I guess. Right. So,
like,
they're
selling identity theft prevention services. Surely they know who's thieving identities.
But look at the URL. These guys are totslegit.com. Who'd have thought that was a problem? Now, Apple is still continuing to come out to the press and say, look, we don't want to spy on iMessages. We can't spy on iMessages, which is kind of disingenuous because they run the CA architecture, they could actually active man in the middle their messages. But they're saying, we don't do it, we can't really do it, we haven't set it up that way, so we value your privacy. So it's really interesting seeing this shift towards you know, privacy against interception becoming a key PR message for such a big company.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, probably a good thing for a lot of us. But you know, I guess for those from Apple who are listening, you know, really, I guess what we have to see is some actual technical architecture that makes it not possible, not just, well, we didn't really engineer that, even though we know we can, we just didn't.
Like
that's not
maybe
very
some
reassuring.
Perfect forward secrecy and some fingerprint funny business detection. That'd
be good. And you know, some way of actually doing end-to-end keying and some way of validating who we're talking to in the style of silent circles.
In the style of OTR would be okay.
But yeah,
I mean,
you
could key him in the background anyway and only throw an alert when there was a new...
I mean, that kind of transient key validation, like, absolutely would work. But yeah, it's nice that Apple are coming out and saying that we value privacy and we don't do it. But let's build a technical system that means you can't, right?
Yeah.
Then we'll believe you and we don't have to take it on faith.
iOS 7.1, guys? Guys?
Maybe.
Oh, Snoopy's been updated. Snoopy is a really cool tool that was put together by Glenn Wilkinson and Dan Cuthbert at SensePost. And apparently, yeah, it's just had a bit of an upgrade. But Snoopy lets you do really creepy stuff with capturing people's SSID probes, and then you can figure out where they live and stuff.
Yeah.
Cool. And you can synchronize a whole lot. You can have a whole bunch of Snoopy sensors out there and then centralize them.
Yeah, and that's really the value of Snoopy, is that it weaponizes things that we could do on a relatively small scale easily, but, you know, running multiple sniffing stations and correlating all that data and then actually being able to track people across space and time using, you know, the probe requests from their portable devices with, you know, with a nice GUI and all that kind of thing. Like, that is, you know, it's genuinely useful for, you know, targeting individual people or, you know, attacking devices when they're outside of the corporate wireless umbrella. So, yeah, interesting stuff. And, I'm looking forward to having a play with it, actually.
Yeah, well, anyone heading to Black Hat in Brazil and Zero Nights in Russia can actually have a look at the upgrades to Snoopy. So congratulations, guys. I'm sure that'll be awesome. Oh, 7 Eastern Europeans have been indicted in a multi-million-dollar eBay fraud scheme. Now, the reason I highlighted this one, the reason that I've selected this one for the news this week, is because these guys really went to some effort to make their listings look legitimate. And we're talking about setting up fake car dealership websites. We're talking about, you know, all sorts of subterfuge, which really paints a picture for a person that they're engaging with a legitimate organization. So, yeah, I mean, that's something to be aware of, I guess. Consumers might not know that scammers out there are setting up what look to be really legitimate businesses online and then listing through companies like eBay.
Yeah, I mean, the fact they were making, you know, something like $1 million, you know, the effort to put together a, you know, fake used car salesman website to make your eBay listings look a bit more legit. Like, I mean, it's relatively small, small cost for the kind of return they were getting. So, I mean, you should certainly expect this, I think.
Now, this one's interesting. The UN nuclear regulator, which is the Atomic Energy Agency, the IEA, the IAEA, which I think John Stewart always used to call the IAEA blah. Apparently someone went into their like visitors area and dropped a bunch of malware on the visitors' computers. And yeah, that's going to be – I'm guessing they get some pretty interesting visitors at that place. So that was kind of what they were going for. You know, they're saying, hey, we didn't get owned, but guys, your kiosks did, and that means your visitors did. So
yeah, and I think, you know, an organization like that, you would absolutely expect to be targeted. And if this is the only you know, compromise they've got, then I would be very, very surprised. But yeah, they owned by USB drop in their public areas. Like, you know, you've got to be vigilant against this sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think it kind of crazy to have public kiosks.
You might want to have, you know, nuclear non-proliferation information available in your lobby in case, you know, people are wondering whilst they're waiting.
But with
they're
USB
waiting.
Ports.
Yeah, well, just, does seem like a poor idea, doesn't it?
It does seem like a poor idea. Oh, now Safari, you know, OS 10.9 Mavericks is out. And they've sandboxed the crap out of Flash in the Safari, yeah. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, nice to see. You know, Adobe have been working with Apple, and they've actually managed to implement sandboxing for that. So that's a, you know, certainly a great thing for the poor Mac users running Flash with Safari.
Yeah, why why run Safari? But anyway, now there was some news a couple of months ago about the emergency alert system in America containing all of these sort of vulnerabilities. So you can like get on TV and be like, "Hi, Mom," you know, through the emergency system, but you know, and they go out to phones and SMSs and special alert systems on phones, and apparently they're still not fixed, which is kind of, you know, you would expect a bit of movement on that one.
Yeah, so there was a vulnerability reported a while ago where, you know, essentially all of these boxes, it was just embedded Linux systems or one particular vendor's systems that do this emergency alert notification thing, they all had the same SSH keys, like the same private key was shared across all the boxes, and of course you pull it off one, you can now log into all of them, and that was you know, that's pretty dumb. It is
pretty dumb, but you can see why they would make it. They would go for accessibility over security, right?
Sure, sure. But the funny thing is they've started rolling out patches for that particular floor without actually then changing the shared root password that is also the same on all of their boxes. Now, you'd think, like, maybe you're fixing one of these things. You know people are looking. Like, let's just save everybody the embarrassment and the effort and fix them both at once. But no.
Yeah, but I suppose the last thing you want to be doing when there's the wildfire approaching the town is like, shit, who's got the password, you know? Like, so again, I think, you know, they're probably just going to have to wear this, and if people start abusing it, then it's time to fix it.
Yeah, then we'll see more, you know, zombie apocalypses being announced.
Yeah, exactly, right?
Apocalypses?
Yeah. Apocalypse. I like that. Because you're only used to the idea of there being one apocalypse, aren't you?
But yeah, when you've got, you know, seven.
Oh, now, this is pretty awesome. There was a Android ad network... basically, you know, you embed ads in apps and whatnot. But apparently this ad framework was a complete bloody nightmare. But it's been fixed to a degree. But FireEye have done a bunch of work in this space.
Yeah, so this was an ad network that, you know, I guess did many of the things you would expect, you know, an Android application ad framework would do, and provided, you know, some data about the users and provided ways for, you know, to sell targeted advertising to users of applications on Android. But it just had a whole world of capabilities that, you know, maybe weren't strictly necessary, you know, things like harvesting an address book and contacts.
Not strictly necessary,
but also included the capability to download extra components over the internet and just run them. So they, you know, it's essentially, you know,
I think that's what we call in the biz arbitrary code execution.
pretty much, yeah. I mean, you know, it could easily be a rat or a botnet. It just happened to be also selling advertising as its primary business model, with, you know, plenty of other options for other monetization in the future, should the author decide that's what he wanted to do. But anyway, so Google have waved a stick at them thanks to FireEye's prodding about, and, you know, maybe it will improve, maybe it won't.
Yeah, well, hopefully it does. But yeah, all of that, oh man, I mean, you see some of that adware stuff in mobile apps, and it looks like 1998, man.
Yeah,
you know,
wow,
it's just dodgy.
Well, because it is.
Yeah. There's some wireless industrial automation software that apparently is quite common in industrial plants, and the problem with this wireless stuff is they haven't used strong crypto with it, And people are starting to turn their attention to it now and realizing, well, hey, okay, there's a bit of encryption here, but we can crack it pretty easy. And that's bad because, you know, these are big machines that make big noise and have steam and stuff.
Yeah. And then once again, this is, you know, technology that's in many cases 20, 25 years old and, you know, was just never engineered against malicious adversaries, yeah. really. I mean, this is, you know, stuff that's meant to, you know, reliability, availability is the important aspect here. You know, and the fact that there's any crypto at all on this protocol is amazing. The fact that the crypto is rubbish, you know, I don't think we're particularly surprised. But,
no, so what is that? ProSoft Technology Radio Links Controlscape. And apparently their pseudo-random number generator is not very good.
Yeah, and I'm amazed that the guys who did this research were from IOActive. You know, I'm amazed they had to go as far as looking at the quality of the PRNG to bust the stuff. But they did, and they've you know, found a way to break into the radio links and then onwards from there into the control systems, which, you know, it's bad. It's the kind of bad we expect, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But, you know, this stuff just doesn't get fixed quickly. And
well, especially wireless, though, because it's something you can do. I mean, I seem to recall a photo of you hiding in the bushes, camoed up with a bloody Pringles can or something, you know, owning up some super secret facility. I mean, that's, you know, it's really bad. It's particularly serious when you're dealing with a wireless issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, yeah, the fact that you can, you know, in that case, I was, you know, sitting, you know, several hundred meters away from the facility we were targeting, and we did compromise control systems using it was a little bigger than a Pringles can, I'll have you know. Like, I had to carry a 29 dBi parabolic grid through the bushes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to offend the manliness, or question the manliness of your antenna.
No, ain't no Pringles can, son. That was
note to listeners, if you see beards in your forest, it's time to pull the wireless. Then we're just going to do a quick bug roundup. Cisco again. More remote code execution bugs in Cisco kit. Six products.
More Cisco bugs. Although in this particular case, nearly all of these bugs are because they're using the Apache Struts framework, which they're fixing the bug that got dropped. That must be 6 months ago that thing got announced. But there's embedded Struts in lots of applications, and Cisco, yeah, is patching a few of them finally. But that's just not a good look for them. And we've seen just such a bad run from Cisco lately.
Apple has fixed apparently more than 100 vulnerabilities, you know, across the new version of OS X. And, you know, they've just released a bunch of new stuff, and this is what they tend to do, is roll fixes into their point releases.
Yeah,
no surprises there.
You should definitely upgrade all of your Apple things. I mean, there's, as you say, bugs fixed across the browser, across the OSs, and in some of the applications as well. So pretty much patch all of the Apple things.
All of the Apple things, and Mavericks is free, which is kind of nice.
Well,
right?
That's probably maybe some of those bugs are really awful, and they don't want to be busted having people pay for security updates after Adobe.
Oh man, I gave him so much crap over that in 2003 in a ZDNet article where I actually gave it the headline of because they weren't patching stuff; they were just releasing the next upgrade. And I gave it the headline, Apple charges $139 for security patch. And man, did the fanboys get upset. That was like, yeah, that was, yeah, that was fun. Now, Netgear's readiness, storage stuff, you know, it's basically home storage stuff. That stuff is vulnerable to a command injection flaw. We're seeing, you know, a pretty steady stream of like Netgear D-Link sort of bugs.
Yeah, I think, you know, and pretty much all of those consumer grade embedded systems, like the admin interfaces, are all rubbish and shells.
I know.
Out of all of them. But, and we will, as you say, we've seen a stream and we will continue to see a stream because they're
poor consumers, because here's us just totally not giving a shit.
Well, exactly right. I mean, if you run a Netgear, you're going to have a bad time, right? That's just how it is.
Oh, Verizon too, you know. I mean, I know they give all of their data to the US government, but apparently they were exposing a bunch more data there was some sort of Verizon Wireless problem with one of their websites that exposed users' SMS history, which would have enabled you to do some pretty decent traffic analysis on your target. This is bad, 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 bad.
Yeah,
but it's fixed.
Essentially, they had a web interface which would show you the portions of your phone bill that you had not yet been billed for. And of course, the phone number that you were asking about that was yours was just a GET parameter in the URL. And yeah, you just change it and they give you other people's data, you know, direct object reference, like it is the year, you know, what, 2002 AD, maybe.
Careful, man. Don't get too lippy about this or you wind up in the cell next to Weave.
I was going to say, like, Weave will be kicking himself for missing this one because, yeah, this is way better than, stupid
getting iPad UDIDs or whatever.
Stupid Verizon. Don't do that again. Bad.
Well, that's actually it for the news this week. But I wanted to have a bit of a chat to you about Jonathan Brossard's talk here at Breakpoint. Pretty interesting stuff. I mean, he was looking at basically, you know, bypassing kit like FireEye. And I had a bit of a chat to him. I interviewed him. We're about to hear the interview. But I interviewed him, and a couple hours later, I actually got a call from FireEye PR in Sydney going, so I hear you want to talk about sandboxes. We don't make sandboxes. Who are you talking to? What's going on? I was just like, you know, come again. So I think there's a FireEye guy here who might have actually snitched on me.
Must be a rat in the room.
He ratted me out. So yeah, but I mean, what did you think of the research? Because I want to make sure we get another opinion on this research. FireEye, I actually spoke to one of their people today, and he's like, well, look, you know, we can mitigate some red pills. By default, we're about to hear that you can actually use, you know, code execution in their sandbox to do DNS recon, which is kind of bad, but they're like, hey, by default, that's kind of turned off. But what was your take on the talk?
I think that essentially there was, I suppose, three core issues that, that Jonathan was bringing up. Like, one is the ability to bypass, you know, sandbox based evaluation of malware through red pill techniques, like spotting the fact you're in a sandbox and modifying your behavior. And that's just, you know, it's in.
Or just stopping your behavior.
Or just stopping your behavior. Yeah. Like, I mean, that's inherent in any kind of sandboxing technology.
Well, and that just reduces their problem then to not looking for connectbacks or changing registry keys. Then they've got to actually detect that something is executed. And if that was reliable and simple, you'd be doing it on the host.
Well, exactly, yeah. So I guess that's issue number one. And I think that is, you know, that's just a property of the technology. The second thing that he brought up really was, I think, the general code quality and build quality of the FireEye product. And I think we will, you know, if FireEye want to provide a box for him to look at, then we will have some ideas about exactly what that code quality is like.
Funny you should say that, Adam, because I asked them why they wouldn't provide machines to security testers for eval, and they said because it's proprietary and that's our secret sauce.
Yeah. I'm not sure about what the embedded Sophos inside may not be your secret sauce, but anyway, yeah. Let's just not talk about the code quality so much. And I think the third issue really is in the configurations where you've got the fire or sandboxing devices connecting with the ability to connect out to the network, then using that as a free shell in the DMZ or wherever the box is located to then be able to look at the network from a different perspective, talk to the internal DNS perhaps, talk to the internal proxy perhaps, and then use that to attack onwards into the rest of the network or to attack other people. That's an interesting kind of red team pen testing hacker technique that I had never thought of, and that was the thing I got out of Jonathan's talk. But you know, I think each of those three things independently you could discuss with FireEye PR, and they may have things to say. But you know, fundamentally, that kind of sandboxing tech, you know, it does have limitations, and you have to be realistic about what it buys you and at what cost.
Yeah, and knowing that if you've configured it wrong, it's going to get you owned pretty hard.
Well, and that's the same with nearly all security tech, right? The amount of people have been owned through their snort or their IDS management console, their spam filtering, or their existing AV.
Or their CA anything.
Or their CA anything, exactly.
Well, we're going to hear from Jonathan in just a moment. But Adam, thank you very much for having a chat to us this week at Breakpoint about the week's security news.
Cheers, Pat. It's fun to catch up and do this in person.
That was Adam Voileau there with a look at the week's news headlines, and it is time for this week's feature interview now with Jonathan Brossard from Toucan Systems. Jonathan is an Australia-based security researcher. You might be able to detect his French accent, though. And he has a knack for messing with virtualized systems. Now, he decided to turn his attentions recently towards sort of gateway malware scanners and found they've got issues, man. So I pulled him aside at Breakpoint in Melbourne and asked him to recap his talk. Here's what he had to say.
So the idea is there's a number of upcoming technologies regarding sandboxing, which are like the new silver bullet offered by the antivirus industry to automatically detect 0 days. And the whole purpose of my talk was to show the limits of such technologies and saying that there is really room for problem and that actually I don't believe this is quite going to work at all.
I think the way you actually phrased it in the talk was to say that claims by companies like FireEye that they can block 0 day, what was it? F***ing bullshit.
Yeah, well, pardon my French, but yeah, that's f***ing bullshit. Like, not too surprisingly, like, you know, automated detection of 0 days, like, is probably impossible. Fundamentally, there's a problem called the halting problem, which shows that, you know, from a fundamental point of view, it's impossible, even if you have the binary, represent all these states in memory and prove that the binary is going to end up one day. So let alone crash, it's impossible to know if an application is ever going to stop. So provably find every type of 0 day in an automated way is nonsense. Yeah.
So how does one go about bypassing? I understand that the talk did mostly focus on FireEye, and you gave a couple of examples of how to bypass their detection. Hey, I can beep that out later if you want me to, but how does one go about actually bypassing that? Say I'm a bad guy, I'm cobbling together a nasty PDF that I want to sneak through in a spear phishing campaign. How do I do it?
So first off, you know, I was not especially targeting FireEye. It turns out that FireEye is a market leader in this technology, and they were first to market. So definitely, like, you know, it's something which is interesting. But it's worth remembering that everybody following the same way. If you speak with antivirus vendors these days, they essentially believe that desktop antivirus is dead. It's not working anymore. It was working, like, you know, 20 years ago when we had so many viruses. But nowadays, like, you know, we produce something like 50,000 an hour. So the signature model is dead and is not working anymore. So as an alternative solution, so FireEye was the first one to offer running every piece of document or every unknown piece of binary which is incoming to the network, being it because you download it from the internet or because it's incoming as an attachment to an email, inside a sandbox, which sounds like a good idea. And you know, run a behavioral analysis. Like, look, for example, if you run a PDF inside a sandbox and you open it with your PDF reader, if at some point the PDF reader is trying to connect back to the internet to download an .exe, you may say, like, okay, this is unexpected and this is probably an exploit. The problem we outline of our different nature, some are like a very deep design and architectural problems, like the fact of allowing, essentially the biggest problem is that they're allowing the malware or the PDF or whatever to connect back to the internet. And this is pretty crazy. Like, instead of emulating the network...
they actually allow in their sandboxes.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. That's the crazy bit. Like, if you allow, like, the malware to connect back to the internet, and so every vendor I've seen of such solution allows it. FireEye was the first one to do it.
This is news. Yeah. I had no idea. So when your FireEye or whatever gateway actually takes a suspicious file and, you know, it executes in the sandbox, you can actually sit there on the outside and know that that gateway has detected your malware.
So that's one possibility. So, yeah. Well, I mean, intuitively, you're seeing why this is going to end wrong, right? So at first, the idea was to emulate this, and not allow a proper connection, but it's a very limited solution because imagine you have malware which is encrypted and to decrypt itself needs actually to connect back to the internet.
Okay.
For instance, because the decryption key is inside a DNS query, you know, a DNS answer.
Okay, now it makes sense, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, but if you allow it to connect back to the internet, you opening a Pandora box and you're doing something very crazy. So first off, if you don't do it on a separate line and you do it using your main internet connection, you're going to pollute your DNS cache because the attacker is going to have it both ways. He's going to be emitting the request and possibly spoofing the answers, and you can synchronize both. So you, like, the fact that of polluting your DNS is a given, or you could, like, you know, pollute your proxy cache and stuff like that. But let alone this, even if simply the malware can send back a copy of itself to the same email gateway or stuff like that, let's say every piece of malware sends two copies of itself to the same mail server, is going to get, like, exponential execution time. And that's not going to work very well either. So, those are some of the limits of such technologies.
Well, one of the other problems, too, isn't it, that you can quite reliably detect when you're running in a sandbox. So then, you know, forget about looking at connectbacks. You pop execution, then the first thing you do is see if you're running in one of these sort of, you know, sandboxes. It's almost like a VM. And if you're running in there, just don't do anything. So then you're boiling the question down not to spotting registry value changes or connectbacks, which is easy to see, but how to spot execution. And if you could spot execution reliably, you'd just be doing that on the host anyway, right?
Yeah. So sandboxing is totally a virtual machine, first off. And so detecting the fact that you virtualized, we call that a red pill. And it's a given. Like, finding a red pill, if you give me any virtual machine, I can find you a red pill in minutes, right? That's a given, because the CPU is not perfectly emulated and things like this. So that's going to be a given. But it triggers other problems. Like we explained that if you have this thing running inside a web page in an automated way for analysis, we can actually have turn very lame bugs into sandbox oracles to determine like what is the environment the VM is running on and stuff like that. So
you can turn your malware into a recon tool to figure out the defenses and then work on a second stage attack that bypasses it.
For instance, essentially, for every malware you submit, if you craft it properly, you get one bit of information back, which allows you to detect, like, you know, file which exists over there or what is the address you executed in memory and things like this. So, yeah, that helps for remote execution, totally. So the whole point of my talk, what I find crazy is that, so you were mentioning FireEye, they claim 30% market share across the top 100 companies in the world, and nobody did a third-party assessment. When researchers like myself ask for, you know, a copy to do due diligence, they automatically say no. And that's a problem. If it's actually running on 30% of the network of those companies, then that's called warmable.
Food for thought. Jonathan Brossard, thank you very much for your time.
No worries, mate. Thanks for your time.
Jonathan Brossard there with a discussion around sandbox scanners for malware, which are not a silver bullet, apparently, which is good to know. Okay, up next it is time for a chat with Chris Gatford of Hack Labs in this week's sponsor interview. Hack Labs are an Australian penetration testing firm, and you can find them at hacklabs.com. I got Chris on the line via Skype to talk about IBM Switzerland's new WhizBang NFC two-factor authentication implementation. It's a pretty simple idea. You can use your PayPass NFC card and the NFC reader in your phone to do transaction authentication from an app on your smartphone. I mean, it's a reasonable scheme, especially when you combine it with a well-written, purpose-built mobile app. So, you know, when you're ready to authenticate, you just pull out the card and bump it to your phone. Simple, reasonably effective, and Chris says such schemes might succeed given the popularity of NFC-based payment cards. Here he is.
It's amazing the uptake that supermarkets are seeing on contact NFC-type PayWave cards. In fact, in the last 12 months, let me just say last 6 months, since a major chain adopted NFC PayWave cards at terminals, nearly half of all the transactions now are PayWave based.
That wouldn't surprise me because I got my first PayWave card a few months ago and I'm absolutely hooked on using it and I can't stop using it. And in fact, when people ask me at the checkout how I would like to pay, I have taken to saying, by magic. So, yeah, I mean, it seems like it is really taking off. It is the next big thing. I mean, there are some fraud concerns. I'm wondering how much longer the banks are going to swallow the fraud on these things. We had a great example in my town where someone, like, lost their wallet. Someone grabbed their PayWave card and went on a, $100 at a time shopping spree among, a zillion stores all around the town and then gradually went up the coast, stopping at town by town by town, just going nuts on it before the card got cut off. I mean, the bank would have to cover all of that. But it seems like it is really popular, hey?
It is. And, the technology is convenient. One could argue it's certainly more secure than magstripes. In fact, one of the other more common fraud things we've heard recently is that people who are able to actually do anything fraudulent with a PayWave card, they're more likely to convert that to a PAN and use that overseas in terms of, some of the crime gangs.
Yeah, I think it's the casual fraud aspect with this that you got to watch, though. The fact that, you don't, unlike a magstripe card, you don't actually need a PIN to use it. You just tap it and off you go. But really the reason we're talking about this, though, is because of this IBM research lab stuff out of Zurich, which shows that they can use these PayWave cards to do things like authenticate to online banking through online banking applications for smartphones. Do you think, given that the uptake of PayWave and that sort of thing is so high, do you think that we're going to see more applications like that for NFC?
It's certainly becoming very popular with IBM's solution that they've announced, coupling the PayWave credit card with the mobile app to do authentication as a second factor. Yeah, look, that's certainly better than just sticking on username and password, right? So as long as we're getting away from that, that's great. If they make it easier and convenient, everyone's got one of them in their pocket, it's very likely, as we're seeing the trend to PayWave, it will be successful.
I'm kind of surprised we haven't seen much already, and I'm also surprised that we don't have many NFC readers in, you know, commodity hardware yet. Do you think that'll change?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, obviously the cost of that type of equipment is coming down all the time. As we see payment terminals being changed as well, a lot of the payment terminal manufacturers, if you watch, they're actually sort of changing their business model because a lot of them are foreseeing the cheap, very cheap NFC reader type solution replacing these expensive leased devices that you get from all the major brands. And some of the now they're moving towards being advertising devices. So on the payment terminal, next time you go to do a transaction, you'll see two or three ads. So they're actually starting to turn those terminals now into actual advertising solutions because the major manufacterers of these, Ugenco, Vericom, are starting to see the writing on the wall where we'll start seeing NFC-based payment terminals very cheaply made by other providers going over the internet. You think about the PayPal-type examples and Google Wallet examples. So there is some writing on the wall about how this is going to change, and certainly it's very easy to see NFC becoming very popular.
Now, we've long known that there are some problems with the way NFC cards have been implemented. You can actually do sort of like proxied attacks. So, you know, you can hold one smartphone up to some dude's wallet at the pub while your mate is at the bar holding their phone over the reader, and you can sort of do a replay attack and suck money off someone else's card. Now, that was sort of seen when it was first demonstrated. Those sorts of techniques were kind of seen as like, oh yeah, a bit of a party trick, but not really that likely, not really that useful. Now that NFC-based cards and PayWave cards are in so many people's wallets and people are starting to use them to pay for things like beers at the pub, do you think we're actually going to see some scams emerge? Do you think we're going to start to see scams emerge to the point where they might have to produce NFC cards where you have to hold a button before they're active or something like that?
I suppose there's two things to that question. Look, any time there's an opportunity for criminals to make money, you know, they'll go after it. It just depends how much they're going to make and how frequent. I think with the trying to scam other people's wallets, I just still think that given the proximity you have to have, given the number of cards that most people have in their wallet, which, you know, just kind of stops them all from working anyhow, I doubt that will become a realistic scam. It's just going to stay a party trick.
So you don't think we're going to see a boom in micro fraud because of wireless payments?
Not with the method we just described. There might be other techniques that will come out over time. One of the guys in the office did sort of work out how big an antenna would have to be at one stage to read a PayWave card from a decent part away. He said two things. One, it would be the size of the door. And two, you probably get radiated as you walk through the field. So
that's it. Now, would you agree that some other forms, at least, of two-factor authentication are next to useless? Because I think tokens, one-time passwords through soft or hard tokens, I just really don't understand why people persevere with them anymore in banking applications, considering the Zeus Trojan has been around for years and completely circumvents them because it's a man-in-browser style attack.
Against specific malware, you know, that obviously hoovers those up as well. Even social engineering exercises, you know, where we will ask for the second factor authentication in the social engineering exercise we're doing as part of the phishing page that we put up. So look, it's still better than username and password, so we still have to have two-factor authentication. I still think it's better than username and password. There will always be methods to circumvent and undermine them, but for the most part, it's going to stop the majority of low-level fraud. Have you seen the YubiKey? YubiKey is an open-source two-factor authentication device, and very simplistic. It's sort of a indestructible USB flat device. You press the little gold contact on top and it does a one-time password from the actual device. But there's lots of open source modules. So you can have easily connect it to sort of about anything, AD, all the major LDAP providers. It's really quite a clever solution. It's cheap. And so when we see that, when we see organizations not using two-factor and they're complaining about budget, there really is no excuse anymore.
All righty. Well, Chris Gatford, thank you very much for joining us to have a bit of a chat about IBM's latest NFC-based authentication scheme.
You're welcome, Pat. Always a pleasure.
Chris Gatford there with a chat about NFC cards as a second factor solution. And that is it for this week's show. This week's track is another one by Jaffa, and it's called Something Good. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Now that you can see, you can't find it. You can try, but you find nobody's gonna buy it. Play their way, you know that you end up lost. Can't you see, don't you listen to them? All of these things, every break, every bend. There's only one cure. There's only one cure. You have a lonely heart. Starting something now. Started something new. You can tell your friends, but they can't see, can't understand. Until we find a good thing, the good thing. Yourself a break, maybe you're digging an early grave. The stress, you're a mess, it ain't getting you nowhere. Honey, just step back, take a look, you will know if it's wrong. Trust in time, think of giving and finding the ways of the heart. I see the true love is blind. There's only one cure word. Thank you.